Today is Friday, January 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the government shutdown continues, President Trump says he never meant Mexico would write a check for his wall.
Obviously, they're not going to write a check, but they are paying for the wall indirectly many, many times over.
The president's former attorney plans to tell all to Congress.
We are in search of the truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Congress remembers murdered reporter Jamal Khashoggi as they look to draw attention to the dangers journalists face. And Western powers are voicing skepticism over concerns about the DRC election results. It's all on today's International Edition, and we're glad to have you. The U.S. Senate Thursday night unanimously passed a bill guaranteeing federal workers will get paid everything they are owed when the government shutdown ends. And while it sounds like good news, it won't be immediately helpful to the more than 800,000 workers who are missing their first payday this week. When the shutdown enters its fourth week Saturday morning, it will set the record for the longest in U.S. history with no end in sight. President Trump visited the border town of McAllen, Texas, Thursday, saying he may be forced to declare a national emergency.
We're either going to have a win, make a compromise, because I think a compromise is a win for everybody, or I will declare a national emergency.
While in McAllen, Trump visited a Border Patrol station and inspected a table heaped with illegal drugs and weapons. He was told most of the contraband was seized at legal points of entry, not the remote border crossings the president says need to be sealed off. The president also met with families of those killed by immigrants in the country illegally. Trump said a wall works and made the promise of the wall a centerpiece of his 2016 campaign, insisting Mexico would pay for it. But he said on Thursday,
I never said this and I never meant they're going to write out a check. I said they're going to pay for it. They are.
Although this contradicts statements he did make during the campaign, Trump has more recently said the benefits from a renegotiated North American trade agreement would lead to Mexico paying for it. The 800,000 federal workers not being paid or working or without pay due to the partial U.S. government shutdown were the first to feel its impact. But as Anna Cook reports, other segments of the economy are also being hurt, especially in Washington, D.C., home to the largest number of federal workers in the country.
As a partial government shutdown continues, businesses from local restaurants to rideshare drivers in Washington are feeling the hit.
I'm trying to work to make a little extra money to make a living for myself, you know. It's pretty tough.
No customers coming here. We cannot pay our rent, we cannot pay salary. It's too much.
The prolonged shutdown only has negative effects on the economy and businesses across the nation, says Sam Berger, who was a policy advisor during the 2013 shutdown.
I think according to the White House, it's like $2.5 billion a week. And I think it's not just though the straight numbers of the economic effect, it's the hardship that's being sort of rippling throughout, the challenges that it's posing for small businesses.
Despite the impact the government shutdown is having on local businesses, President Trump continues to push for funding the border wall with Mexico.
The only solution is for Democrats to pass a spending bill that defends our borders and reopens the government.
Congressional Democrats oppose a wall and believe Trump is holding the country hostage to deliver on a core campaign promise. People in the capital city are frustrated by the standoff.
Right now, it's so slow. It looked like it was really dead this morning. No action, nobody around.
Whatever you're asking for, give it to them. Because, you know, at this point, it hurts everybody.
Since the shutdown began in December, some restaurants have been offering free food at a designated time of the day to help furloughed federal employees who are not being paid.
From 6 to 8, government furlough workers get free pizzas, and I think that's awesome because there's so many people who aren't able to make, you know, ends meet sometimes.
On Saturday, the shutdown becomes the longest in U.S. history. Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the national emergency declaration the president's talking about would allow him to spend the money without congressional approval, and it would likely bring an immediate court challenge from Democrats who say there's no emergency at the border, that the president would be overstepping his constitutional authority. Joining us now to discuss how the president could do this, declaring a national emergency and get the funding, Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. Tell us.
there's a few issues here, right? Number one is there actually a national security crisis or a problem at the border of national security? And I think in a lot of ways, that's in the eye of the beholder. There are clearly a lot of people in this country who feel like there is a crisis at the border, that there's a huge issue of illegal immigration. It's causing dislocations in the economy. It's causing crime and the like to increase. There's a lot of people that feel that way. The president made that point on the campaign trail and ultimately was elected. And that was one of his key points on the campaign trail. There are a lot of people who feel the opposite way and actually say, actually, illegal immigrants are coming across to take jobs that Americans don't want. And there are a lot of businesses, in fact, that say without illegal immigration or a legal form of immigration from those Central and South American countries into the United States to take some of these farm jobs and the like, that we wouldn't have a viable agriculture economy.
I've also been hearing that because of the shutdown, that intelligence and cybersecurity are taking hits.
Anytime the government shuts down, there are certain critical government functions that continue. And so a lot of the government is still open in that sense. Most of our national security agencies are open. But a lot of the quote-unquote non-essential personnel, even those agencies, the National Security Agency, the CIA, and the like, are furloughed. And because they're furloughed, that means that the job is not done as efficiently, as effectively. So critical jobs, TSA, for example, I was at the airport today. TSA is up and running, but they're not functioning necessarily at full strength. The administrative people around those jobs are not there, and that makes the job harder to do. By the way, note that all these people who are there as essential personnel are not currently getting paid. So they're working their jobs. All these TSA employees are at the airports doing screenings, but they're not going to get paid when paychecks are due, I think, either today or tomorrow. People are going to start having real problems soon. It will be increasingly hard to sustain this as the weeks and months go by.
Right. We're actually in a couple of days heading toward now being the longest government shutdown in the U.S. And then you've got an FBI agents group, Federal Bureau of Investigation agents, saying that it's putting national security at risk, investigation operations at risk. They're not getting paid. There are a lot of groups now speaking out that are worried, concerned. And the president may, from what we're hearing, try to end this thing by declaring this a national emergency. His supporters are in agreement that, okay, it will go to the courts, but it'll end the shutdown, and the military will ultimately pay for this wall. But others are arguing that this would be an abuse of power, and it would sort of lessen the legitimacy of actual emergencies. What do you say about something like this?
The law that is sort of in place today, the National Emergencies Act, passed in the 70s, and the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, those are the two main statutes at play here, and the president has broad authority to declare a national emergency sort of as he or she sees fit. We have over 30 today existing national emergencies, some going all the way back to 1979, the Iran hostage crisis. I think the president has the authority as a legal matter to probably make the declaration. But then the next question of can he invoke a couple of these statutes that appears he's considering that go to the use of military construction authorities or monies or other military appropriations to fund the building of the wall. There are particular provisions of those statutes that relate to support for the armed forces or in the national defense. He is going to have to meet those, and there will be a debate. And like you say, maybe it's an issue before the court. You know, under these kind of things, the president generally is seen to have broad authority, and courts do defer to his views on his or her views on national security issues. And
we've got this. Almost the longest U.S. government shutdown, government workers not being paid, worried about how they're going to pay their bills. All of this is a standoff over a wall the president says we absolutely need to keep our country safe and to keep these so-called criminals that are trying to get in out. What do you say about this whole thing and the argument behind it and that this wall is necessary enough to close the government down?
Other than the president, I think that there are very few members of Congress, elected officials, who honestly believe that a physical barrier, a wall, will solve the border crisis, the challenge at the border, the issues of illegal immigration, the issues of illegal drugs. In fact, most evidence suggests that illegal drugs come across the border at authorized checkpoints, not through some, you know, break in the wall or over the fence or the like. It's true that humans do travel over those things, but the question whether a wall is going to solve that, I think, is very debatable, and I think has been hotly debated in Congress for a long time. I think what is a point of disagreement between the parties, between the president and a legitimate disagreement, as opposed to just you have to have a physical wall, is this question of border security and how much border security. Everyone agrees we need more money spent at the border. And the real debate is $5.7 billion for a physical barrier or, you know, $1.3 billion for a physical barrier and some other amounts of money for other border security measures. And it's really, you know, if this were a normal sort of situation between Congress and the White House, you'd probably see some sort of a deal. But because the president has made clear that his view is the wall is the thing, and there he's put himself in a corner that is the only outcome, he now has his back up against the wall. And we're in this shutdown where it's very hard to see a rational outcome here because both sides have backed themselves into a corner.
All right. That's Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. Thanks for being with us. Michael Cohen, U.S. President Donald Trump's estranged personal attorney, said Thursday he will testify in an open session before a congressional panel next month, just weeks before he heads to prison for lying to Congress and other crimes. In a statement, Cohen has provided dozens of hours of testimony about his dealings with Trump to prosecutors since flipping on the president last year, and said that he looks forward to having the privilege of being afforded a platform with which to give a full and credible account of the events which have transpired. The testimony will take place on February 7th before the House Oversight Committee. It was announced by the panel's new Democratic chairman, Representative Elijah Cummings.
We're going to make sure that we do absolutely nothing to interfere with the Mueller investigation. That is very, very important to us. But I can tell you that he's right, so that's fine. But we're going to have a lot more comments coming out later on. Right now, my major concern is making sure that our government is opened up. But as far as this hearing is concerned, we put out our statement. It's a very limited statement, and we plan to do what the American people have asked us to do, and that is to conduct hearings with integrity, with transparency, with honesty, and most importantly, accountability.
That's Cummings, a staunch critic of the Trump administration, says he has asked the White House and the Trump Organization to turn over documents related to hush money payments Cohen made to two women who had alleged affairs with Trump. Trump, who has called his former lawyer a weak person and has accused him of lying to prosecutors to try to get a reduced prison sentence, told reporters Thursday that he is not worried about Cohen's testimony. U.S. lawmakers Thursday called for Washington to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for the killing of Washington-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi at one of the country's consulates in Turkey and vowed that Congress would act if the Trump administration did not. More than a dozen senators and members of the House of Representatives, including both Democrats and Republicans, spoke in an event at the Capitol complex to celebrate a free press and remember Khashoggi and more than 50 other journalists killed around the world last year. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson was on Capitol Hill for the event. She joins us. Catherine, this horrific murder was in the headlines for days, but it has been pushed aside, like a lot of other things, as issues change center stage, and the shutdown is now front and center. But Thursday marked 100 days since Khashoggi's murder.
Absolutely. So they used this 100 days since the death of Khashoggi to really gather together lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, as well as some of Khashoggi's Washington Post journalist colleagues, for a really nice remembrance ceremony up on Capitol Hill, talking about his lasting legacy. And one of the elements that really stood out to me covering this event is that a lot of lawmakers said that their voters, their constituents in their districts, actually realized that press freedom was an issue because they had heard Khashoggi's name. So that really was interesting to hear, that a lot of voters were considering this for the first time, that journalists are out there risking their lives for the story.
Right. And the U.S. standing as far as safety for journalists has gone down in the past year.
That's right. We actually had somewhat of a surprise visit from the new House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at this event. And she had strong words for President Donald Trump for not calling out the Saudi Crown Prince on this issue. She said that there are some things, some values that America stands for that shouldn't be based on relationships relating to currency. So she was very clearly alluding to the fact that America has a dependence on Saudi oil and that the president was reluctant to call out the crown prince because of that.
So this was basically like a commemorative day to remember Mr. Khashoggi on the 100th day to continue to remind people that, you know, journalists risk their lives to get to the truth and how important, you know, freedom of the press is to democracy is basically what I'm hearing you say.
That's right. You know, we have this unfortunate tendency in Washington to have this one big story that consumes all of the attention here. And then we very quickly move on to the next thing. And to be honest, right now, that next thing is the government shutdown and border security.
Right.
I think this was really an opportunity to just come back to this very important issue and remind people that even if we're not paying attention, journalists around the world are still risking their lives.
And I think if anything good can come out of this horrific tragedy, that maybe, you know, in death, Mr. Khashoggi can make a difference in the lives of journalists in the future and their safety and just bringing this much needed issue to attention.
I think that absolutely will be the case and will be the case for a lot of lawmakers up on Capitol Hill.
All right. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, thanks. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Protectionism and dysfunction could hurt U.S. businesses. That's a warning from the Chamber of Commerce. Venezuela's Maduro begins his second term as the crisis deepens there. U.S. will lift sanctions against three Russian companies. And how social media is modernizing the U.S. Congress. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Western skepticism is growing over the Democratic Republic of Congo's announced presidential election results, with France bluntly calling them inconsistent with other findings and former colonial power Belgium planning to raise the matter at the United Nations Security Council on Friday. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
France was quick to react to the surprise win of opposition candidate Félix Tshisekedi in the Democratic Republic of Congo's presidential election.
Il semble bien que les résultats proclamés, Monsieur Tshisekedi.
Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told French TV the announcement did not conform with other results, notably those produced by Congo's Catholic Church, which he described as totally different. Le Drian called for calm and clarity in the true election tally. Former colonial power Belgium was more nuanced. Belgium Foreign Minister Didier Reynders told local RTBF broadcaster his country would bring up the matter at the United Nations Security Council. He said given the chaotic election process, he could understand the fears expressed in some quarters. The DRC's powerful Catholic Church says results tallied by its own election observers do not match the official ones. The church did not name a winner, but reports say its count finds opposition candidate and businessman Martin Fayulu coming out top. Fayulu described the official results as an electoral coup. The European Union, whose ambassador to the DRC was expelled shortly before the vote, also offered a guarded reaction. Spokeswoman Maya Kosiyanjic.
We have also noted that these results have been contested by a part of the opposition. We are also waiting for the reactions of different observation missions that have observed the elections and partners, in particularly in Africa.
The latest developments add to a broader snapshot of disarray and questionable practices in the long overdue vote to succeed President Joseph Kabila. The Enough Project, a U.S. policy group that focuses on Africa, wants the international community to closely scrutinize the results and take action if they are found to be rigged. Sarah Gardner works for the project's investigative initiative called The Sentry.
I think if that process goes forward, there needs to be international support for full transparency and statements to that effect, not excluding the possibility of increased financial pressures, including sanctions and other financial pressures, if the international community deems and that there's proof that a transparent situation is not happening.
Over the past week, the United States and other key governments have urged the Electoral Commission to publish accurate results or face consequences. Washington has also positioned troops in nearby Gabon to protect its assets in Congo and urged U.S. citizens to leave because of security concerns. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. In rural Malawi, families send girls as young as 12 years old for initiation, a traditional cultural practice that marks a child's entry into adulthood. But child rights campaigners say the ritual entices young girls into early sex, marriage, and teenage pregnancy, forcing many to drop out of school. One local organization is seeking to change this by teaching initiation counselors to give girls age-appropriate information. Lamek Messina reports from Wolanje.
Madalitso Makosa was 13 years old when she underwent a traditional Malawian initiation ritual to become an adult.
After the initiation ceremony, the counselors advised me to perform a kusasa fumbi, or removing the dust ritual, with a man of my choice. I chose to sleep with my former boyfriend, but unfortunately I became pregnant.
Removing dust refers to a girl losing her virginity, often without proper protection, to become an adult. Those who become teenage mothers pay the price for this tradition.
When I discovered that I was pregnant, I was devastated because I had to drop out of school. I'm now struggling to get support to take care of my baby. I wish I had continued with my education.
In this initiation demonstration, arranged for a reporter, counselors show how they prepare girls for marriage and for sex.
I give them these lessons so that they will keep their man and prevent him from going out to look for other women. Because if he goes out and finds excitement in other women, he's likely to dump her.
Child rights campaigners say the initiation ritual fuels Malawi's high rate of child marriage. Half of the girls here marry before age 18. Malawian group YouthNet and Counseling, YONECO, wants to keep girls in school with a more age-appropriate initiation ritual.
That's a traditional cultural thing that people believe in, and it would be very difficult to just say, let's end initiation ceremonies. But what we're saying is, can we package the curriculum in such a way that the young people are accessing the correct curriculum at the correct time?
YONECO is working with the initiation counselors and traditional leaders to tone down Malawi's initiations. Already some areas are banning the practice of encouraging sex after the ceremony.
We say no. This is why we have a lot of dropouts from school. That's why we have the population has just shot so high, just because of that. Because a lot of girls now, they have got babies. Most of them, they are not in marriage.
To further discourage teenage pregnancies, traditional leaders like Chikumbu are dividing girls' initiation rituals into two camps. One is a simple ceremony for teenage girls like Makosa, while the other provides sex education for older girls who are preparing to marry. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Mulanje.
Well, Lady Gaga is apologizing for a collaboration with R. Kelly. who's emerged, has been immersed in scandal over allegations of abusing young women. AP correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
Lady Gaga says she's sorry she did this. Gaga did her song Do What You Want With My Body in 2013 as a duet with R. Kelly, the hitmaker who's been the subject of years of allegations that he abused women and girls, charges covered in a new TV series. Gaga says the collaboration came at a dark time in her life as a sex assault survivor and that she should have sought therapy instead. R. Kelly has denied wrongdoing. Warren Levinson, New York.
Well, Victoria Graham is a beauty queen, but what is truly extraordinary about this pageant winner is her efforts to overcome a severe genetic condition that she could use her title wins to highlight her illness. Anoush Avatizyan reports from Manchester, Maryland.
A crown, high heels, and evening gowns galore, Victoria Graham looks every bit the beauty queen. But it's not as simple or easy as it looks. Graham has a severe genetic disorder. She has had 11 operations on her brain and spine. She has a 60-centimeter scar on her back and has to take up to 40 pills every day to make it through.
And I have to set alarms on my phone to remember to do so, or else I'll end up in a lot of pain or passed out on the ground or paralyzed.
The rare incurable disorder she suffers from is called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS. It causes people to lose control of their joints.
I mostly have a lot of pain. Almost all their joints hurt constantly, 24/7. So the first thing we need to do is figure out what components do you have. Is it just hypermobility with a connective tissue disorder? Or do they have neck instability that actually would require maybe a surgical intervention?
But pain never stopped Victoria from fulfilling her dream of becoming a beauty queen. In 2016, she was named Miss White Oak. A year later, Miss Frostburg, Victoria says she has never attempted to hide her scars.
I feel like when I'm able to stand on stage and say, hey, I have an invisible illness or I am disabled, I'm able to speak out for other people and say, we are beautiful. We are whole and complete and perfect in and of ourselves.
She first experienced back pain when she fell from parallel bars at 10. Victoria says doctors could not find anything wrong with her.
One of the hardest times was we went to one doctor and her regular doctor, and her doctor said, I need to take her to another room. And they started asking her questions like, are you happy? And do you have friends? And are you sure you want to do gymnastics? And essentially accusing her of either having depression or she just was trying to manipulate us into not doing gymnastics anymore.
It took 3 years and a 10F physical therapist before Victoria was taken to a geneticist and finally got diagnosis hereditary EDS. Victoria's mom also had EDS and so did her grandmother. It just was not as aggressive.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when she was finally diagnosed, it was actually a happy day for us.
By the time she was 19, Victoria could barely study. Her memory was failing, her neck could not support the school, and she agreed to have surgery. Doctors essentially fused her cranial vertebrae together. Today, Victoria cannot move her neck or turn her head, yet it has not stopped her from participating in beauty pageants and raising awareness about her condition, invisible to the naked eye.
There's a photographer who's actually right here in D.C. He asked if I had had pageant headshots done, and I said, well, no, I had emergency surgery and missed the deadline. So he said, well, step in front of my camera. And I went to go take my neck brace off, and he said, no, keep it on. And I just saw in that moment, oh my goodness, this man is out of his mind. But when I got the pictures a couple weeks later, I looked at them, and it was the first time I saw a photo of myself, and I felt beautiful.
She founded the Zebra Foundation to raise awareness about EDS and show those who suffer from it that life can and should go on.
I have to make choices. Every day when you get up, you have to make a choice if you're going to let the obstacles in your life define you or if you're going to try and rise above them. It's not easy, and there's a price for everything that you do. But I've made the choice today to stand in this gorgeous gown because I want to show that it's possible to do these things.
Anusha Vitisyan, VOA News, Manchester, Maryland.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but we thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Are so beautiful to me.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McKinney.